So let me tell you about the three things that I think you should know about on this day. First of all, Israel has just committed one of the most evil acts that I've seen in a long time, and I've been doing journalism for a long time. I'm going to show it to you. America's number one war hawk and neocon has his home raided. So what did John Bolton do? Or is this just a case of revenge? And on the front lines of Ukraine, the war has shifted with real surprises for one side. We're going to tell you what they are right here on The Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to begin with the latest out of Gaza. Look, when I saw this last night, this video I'm about to show you, I went to X and I wrote that this is one of the most evil things that I've seen in a really long time. And let me set it up for you. Nasser is a hospital. Nasser Hospital is the only place left where in Gaza, Palestinians who survived their current extermination, can still go somewhere to get some kind of medical care. That's what that is. It's a hospital. Israel knows that, by the way. They also know that at any given moment, in this hospital that I'm about to show you, there are at least 1,000 people there. So what then did Israel do? First, they bombed the hospital, hit it with a missile. That's a war crime, by the way. But it's what they did next, which is truly evil. Because then, after they hit it the first time, they waited. And then when care workers and journalists and others showed up at the scene to try and help these victims, to try and, you know, maybe cover the story or do whatever they had to do, this is what Israel did with a second missile. Isn't that amazing? Did you see that? They were just up there trying to help. What Israel likely didn't know is that after the first strike, some reporters from Al Gad TV in Egypt began live streaming this melee with their phones. And that is why the scene was captured, why that attack was actually seen on live television. So the whole world is sitting there watching the reality of Israel's actions. Now, see, usually the IDF doesn't address these kinds of things. They just figure nobody deserves to know, nobody cares. They do. Rarely is anybody held responsible. Those are just the facts, okay? But this time, because the whole world probably saw it on their phones, an IDF spokesperson suddenly came out to the microphone, and of course he then accepted responsibility for this heinous attack on civilians, right? Wrong. He didn't do that. That didn't happen. Instead, he said this.
Earlier today, IDF troops carried out a strike in the area of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. We are aware of reports that harm was caused to civilians, including journalists. I would like to be clear from the start. The IDF does not intentionally target civilians.
It's almost laughable. If you think that sounds like absolute bullcrap, you are then in the company of just about every other thinking human being on the planet Earth, except for perhaps maybe a couple of highly paid politicians and lobbyists in places like London and Washington, highly paid by Israel, by the way. But seriously, how can you shoot a missile into a hospital? Stay with me here. How do you shoot a missile into a hospital with 1,000 friggin' people inside? Patients and nurses and doctors. And then you come out and you have the intestinal fortitude, the audacity to say, oh no, we weren't hitting civilians or we weren't trying to hit civilians. Here it is again.
The IDF does not intentionally target civilians.
It's just crazy. By the way, attacking hospitals is nothing new for Israel. I checked. It's right there on the Googles. Go to the World Health Organization. Here's the numbers. Israel has attacked 464 healthcare facilities. They've killed 727 healthcare workers. They've injured another 933 people. And they've deliberately damaged or destroyed 113 ambulances. How do you hit an ambulance by accident? And by the way, these numbers, this is last June of 2024. So the numbers are actually going to be a hell of a lot higher, right? And I'll show you one example, different from the one I showed you a little while ago. This is about 3 months ago. You're looking at it on your screen. It occurred back in, what, April? And you see the ambulances at the entrance to this emergency ward? And now watch what happens. Yeah, Just another day in Gaza. Do you see any terrorists there, by the way? They dress like terrorists. They say Hamas on. I mean, this is a hospital emergency ward where people are going to get away from the carnage. And once again, what does the IDF say? Just to be sure that we heard them right the first time. Play it again there, Gene.
The IDF does not intentionally target civilians.
So if they're not targeting civilians, Mr. IDF dude, what the hell are they doing? I mean, are my lying eyes deceiving me? What am I missing? You know, if you watch the attack that occurred last night, in fact, here, yeah, show it again, Gene, show it again. You see, it begs the question. Those care workers, those journalists, 15 of them, who were all burned alive and killed in an instant. Did you see any weapons on them? Did they look like they were planning an attack at the time up there trying to rescue people? Were they coming out of one of those infamous tunnels that we hear so much about? And we only showed a short clip. You can find the other one on Google's, right? They're just desperate people. They're racing to a horrific scene to try and help, really just to try and help their neighbors. Let's switch gears now. I want to take you to the United States of America. One of the largest, one of Israel's most ardent defenders is getting what some might call a taste of his own medicine. John Bolton, globalist, neocon, war hawk, Trump hater, by the way, who slams the president all the time for taking classified documents to Mar-a-Lago. Well, guess what? He's now had his home raided by the FBI. And here's the video. This is Mr. Bolton's home being raided, where he lives there in a Maryland suburb. He's being investigated in a criminal investigation into the potential mishandling of classified information, which may have stemmed from information that he revealed in his book, by golly. President Trump says, well, he learned of the raid by watching TV.
I saw that just like everybody else. I try and stay out of that stuff. I'm allowed to be, and I'm chief law enforcement officer, believe it or not. You know, I don't like to go around saying that, but I am. That's the position. But I purposely don't want to really get involved. I don't know anything about it. I just saw that. I'll find out about it. But if you believe the news, which I do, I guess his house was raided today. But my house was raided also.
My house was raided also. Look, I don't know if this is revenge. I don't know if Trump knew about it. I don't know if Trump didn't know about it. Take him at his word. He says he didn't know about it. But forget all that. This should also be noted, because I think this is important. John Bolton has vehemently supported pro-war positions. Off the top of my head, I can think he's wanted war with Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, the Balkans, Cuba, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Lebanon, I'm running out of fingers, Libya, Yemen, just to name a few. This guy wants to have a war with every country in the world. But then I wanted to check about him. You know what I wanted to do? Whenever I read about people like this or know people like this, I always like to go and check to see about them personally, right? What's his own personal war record, right? So I looked it up. And this was actually in Wikipedia, believe it or not. I don't usually trust Wikipedia, but they had some good sources because I checked the sources. He was asked once why he didn't serve in Vietnam when he was a young man, right? It's a guy who wants war with every country. When he had an opportunity to go to war to represent his country, do you know what the quote says? He said, I had no desire at the time to die in some rice paddy in Southeast Asia. Stop quote. Now to the latest on the Ukraine front. This is fascinating. I'm going to show you something here. Look at these pictures. Gene, put those up so people can see those. That's the Ukrainian military encampments that are being taken out. They're being taken out one by one. It's basically the annihilation of 600 troops, 3 tanks, 4 multiple launch rocket systems, dozens of other assorted military vehicles that used to belong or be the part of the Ukrainian military. So how are the Russians doing this, by the way? Well, that's interesting. They're doing it with the use of something the Russians have developed on the battlefield through trial and error. It's called the Iskander missile. This is a specially designed mobile ballistic system. It features essentially missiles with an advanced guidance system, that can be retargeted. Listen to this, retargeted in mid-flight. But it's not just superior missile technology like the Iskander. Remember last week we were talking about the Oreshnik? I mean, these are super weapons that the Russians have now developed, and they've done it because they've been forced to in this war, right? Watch how this well-known, I watch this guy all the time. I think he's pretty good. It's kind of funny, too. This well-known Ukraine war podcaster spells out what has actually been happening this week. Remember, we were all expecting Pokrovsk to be the place where it was all going to happen. He explains that the Russians kind of outsmarted the Ukrainians and went around Pokrovsk. Watch.
My friends, while all eyes are turned on Pokrovsk, the real drama is taking place 170 kilometers to the north in the open fields of Kharkiv Oblast. From their bridgehead over the Oskol River, Russian forces have broken through and are spreading out behind Kupiansk and thus cutting multiple supply lines.
Yeah, did you hear that? They're cutting the supply lines, right? And what that usually means is for a Ukrainian battalion, when they cut the supply lines and flank them like that, they end up like encircled, right? And that happens a lot these days. And what follows is usually not a pretty picture for those Ukrainian soldiers in that situation. So when you can't get out and you can't get anything in because your supply lines are closed down, shut down, that leaves entire Ukrainian battalions pretty much SOL. And that's kind of what's repeatedly happening right now in places like Kupiansk and Kramatorsk. So while Ukrainians went and, you know, the Ukrainians sent the Azov battalion and their big tough guys, and they're all sitting there at Pokrovsk waiting for the Russians did a flank maneuver, went around them, and are hitting other places because they found weaknesses nearby, and apparently they're exploiting it. So the situation, look, the situation for Ukraine right now, and by the way, the Ukrainians don't have enough people to send to that area up north because they don't have enough soldiers. So it's perilous for them. As told, by the way, this is pretty much the way it's being described these days by most military experts and most regional experts. Look at what they're saying. I'll just show you a couple of headlines. Here's Doug McGregor. You know Doug McGregor, the colonel. He's with Glenn Deason. Headline, Ukraine war is over. NATO exhausted itself. Here's Jeffrey Sachs. Sachs, I think, is probably one of the smartest, most experienced, and most honest assessors of geopolitics worldwide. At least I think so. I follow him. Headline, Ukraine war is over. And then there's President Trump. What's he signaling? Well, he's signaling that within the past 24 hours, he's probably seeing the same thing these guys are seeing. And he doesn't want to mess with the Russian military right now, which is why he's now saying on the record, under no circumstances will the United States be sending troops into Ukraine for security purposes. There's the headline. The story's going to no doubt have an impact on Europeans who are getting that message now. If they want to do it, if they want to send their own troops, if they want to go in as peacekeepers or whatever the hell they want to call them, have at it. Go. Do it. But America's saying, you want to do that? Do it on your own. We're not going to join. But here's a problem, I think, for countries that in Europe who want to do that. Germany, for example. Germany's broke right now. I mean, they literally are like bankrupt. 3 years of recession since the war began, by the way. They're in deep doo-doo right now in Germany. Their own leader, their chancellor, gave a speech 3 days ago. And I recorded it for you. I wanted you to see this. So, you know, listen to what he's saying about his own country to his own people. Listen.
We're now in the third year of a recession, and we have to get out of it. This task is greater than some of you may have imagined years ago. We're not just in a weak economic phase. Our economy is in a structural crisis. We're currently not keeping pace with global development. We're no longer the leading industrial nation seen by the world. We're a country that has a structural growth weakness. In large parts of our economy, we're no longer truly competitive. The welfare state we have today can no longer be financed with what we're doing economically.
With what we're doing economically. Yeah, they've laid an egg. So you'd think a guy's telling his own people, we're bankrupt, we're broke, we got no money, we're in a 3-year recession, I got no clue how the hell we're going to get out of this thing, but we're going to have to fight and find a way. And what is that way going to be? Take tax money from the people of Germany and send it to Ukraine, right? You would think that would be the dumbest thing you could if I don't have enough money to feed my kids, how am I going to feed my neighbor's kids? But, you know, like a lot of things that come out of Europe these days, it seems this message is, like, really inconsistent. Because now look at this photo that I'm going to show you. See, that just happened today. We just got that in. That's Germany's finance minister. He's in Ukraine basically saying the opposite of what his chancellor just said. Chancellor says we ain't got no money. He's guaranteeing the Ukrainians that the Germans have plenty of money. So, and they're going to continue to give them the money so that they can continue the war. What in the hell? Anyway, look, Brazilian journalist and columnist at the Cradle, Pepe Escobar, is joining me now to talk about some of these things. He is in Normandy, France. Boy, what a great place to be to talk about some of the things that we're talking about now. In fact, Pepe, good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you.
Because you're there, why don't we start with Germany? I think that's a great place to start. What do you make of the fact that their finance ministers in Ukraine saying, we got a lot of money and we're going to keep giving it to you, while their chancellor saying, we ain't got no money and we're running out quick? Which is it?
I'll give you the headline, Rick. No welfare, only warfare.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah, no. Doesn't it seem crazy? I mean, the example I just made, I got no money, I can't feed my kids this month, but I'm going to somehow try and go and feed my neighbor's kids because my kids need to go hungry. Shouldn't he be thinking about the German people, damn it?
But that's not the point for the current European political elites. And that applies to all of them, starting with the European Commission in Brussels and the prime ministers and leaders in the individual capitals, Berlin, Rome, Paris, etc. The guiding principle is acute Russophobia. The guiding principle is to paint Putin as the Antichrist. Mm-hmm. And I'm not exaggerating. This is what you get from Western mainstream media in block all across Europe. And the guiding principle is we don't care about the population of our NATO state. We only care about the war in Ukraine until the last Ukrainian. And we'll keep paying for it, which is exactly what was the non-discussion between the head of the European Commission and President Trump, when Trump said, okay, continue with the war as long as you have 5% of GDP, buy our super weapons nonstop, pay us in euros, and then the war is yours.
The United States doesn't even have any of those weapons. What they're giving them is has-been weapons.
Don't.
Right. You know that, right?
So, of course they don't. No, because Ukraine is demilitarized, NATO is demilitarized, and the United States is also semi-demilitarized. So to get all those weapons back, it's full tilt production in the U.S. for the next 3 years or so to get to the levels before the SMO, the special military operation in Ukraine. So it's Kafka, if was still alive and he was coming up with the plot of a novel. That's it, in fact.
How does Europe, and I don't know if I ask you this question from the leader's standpoint or from the people's standpoint, but how does Europe allow itself to become a place where the will of the people can be so ignored at their own expense? I was just looking, Pepe, at the favorability ratings of some of these leaders, and it's frightening. I think Macron is at 29%. Starmer's at 23%, dude. 23%. Only 23% of the people of the United Kingdom think Starmer's worth a crap as a leader. 23%. I think this dude, Merz, is at 35, but he was at 38, so he's actually go down. The best in the bunch is the Italian Prime Minister, Meloni. Yeah, and she's at 42. So, I mean, if don't they read this stuff? If they read this, wouldn't they zig or zag here? I got to change my policy, my plan. No, right?
No, they don't, Rick. And they live in a bubble. And when you see the way they actually went to meet Trump in the Oval Office, and afterwards, as the whole planet knows, they were treated like school kids being reprimanded by the headmaster.
Yeah.
And they still believe that they got something out of it, which is to continue their forever war against Russia. You see how they live in a bubble. And in terms of that fake headline that I just gave you, no welfare, more warfare, this is the way they think, actually. And when you have, it's wonderful to have conversations with average Frenchmen, like I had this past few weeks in Brittany or in Normandy, or talk to my Italian friends, and people who don't follow politics on a daily basis. And they say, look, we all know it's wrong, but there's nothing we can do about it. And then a German friend says, look, they're considering Ursula von der Leyen as the next president of Germany. It's not a joke.
Perfect. Perfect. I mean, to me, that makes all the sense in the world, given the past. If past performance is future expectation, then she should be voted in by 100%. Wow. Wow. It doesn't surprise me. By the way, you say, here's the $60,000 question, right? Do they do this because someone's paying them to do this? Are they being influenced by some higher source, like in the United States, the Israelis, for example, or the lobbyists, or the war machine, you know, the contractors, et cetera? Or are they really just that stupid?
It's, yes, this is the $6 million question, Rick.
Thank you.
Yes, they are that stupid, because when you look at the mechanism of how the European Union and the European Commission in Brussels and NATO, the whole Brussels universe, we can call it the Brussels matrix. Mm-hmm. The way it works, you only get to the top positions, like you are a commissioner in Brussels, or you get to the head of the commission, or you go to the Parliament of Europe or the Council of Europe, and then the people want to, okay, now she can become president of something, anything. It's because you fit the mold, and this mold has been refined for the past decade.
Yeah.
Of course, it's an American mold, but it's an Atlanticist mold. It's from the East Coast of the U.S. to all the big capitals, old money, old aristocracy, influence peddlers. For instance, the case of von der Leyen, both families, her family and her husband's family, this is old money in Germany, influencing everything for decades, if not over a century. This is how it works. So these people, there is an iron curtain protecting them from reality, daily life, and especially average European taxpayer who pay, for instance, here in France, just to give an example, people pay an average of over 50% of what they make on all sorts of taxes, which is completely crazy. And the main conversation with anybody in France or in Italy or in Germany for that matter, well, my money disappears at the start of the month. Yes, it does, because it goes all sorts of taxes, direct, indirect, subliminal, underground, you name it. And of course, when the taxpayer said, okay, what about defending our national and regional interests? No, it's Brussels' interests, you know. It comes to the point where you have the average German and Frenchman or Italian, they go to a public building and they see an European Union flag side by side with their national flag, and they are, I cannot say it, they are raging.
Yeah.
Take out this flag from here. These people do not represent us, and they don't.
You feel that. You see it on the streets, huh? I mean, you really do. Those numbers that I just gave, and those are numbers I just recently updated within the last 5 or 6 days, by the way, because numbers are one thing, but when you walk the streets of Paris, I imagine you get a real sense of what the people think, and that's what they think. That's what you sense, right?
Absolutely. And when you get out of the main capitals, Rick, it's fascinating. For instance, this month I'm recharging before going back to Asia. So I went to two top regions in France, Brittany and Normandy. And then you talk to people, fishermen, people in the morning market and all that. It's fascinating. It's better than going to any political science seminar, you know. And then they give you the feeling, the grassroots feeling. For instance, in a few days here in Paris on September 10th, they are playing a huge demonstration, which is basically against everything.
Huh.
The political system, Macron, you name it, everything. They are fed up. And so this is, I heard this from expats living all across Asia, just to give an idea of the reach, how people are absolutely pissed with everything all across, you know. And in the case of Germany, because the Germans are so passive and they don't have that, I would say, extra political acumen of average Italians or average Frenchmen. But the Germans are starting in their underground channels. They are starting to say, look, there's got to be a revolution here.
Forgive me for asking this question, but I can't help myself. Because you're in France, I'm going to ask you this question. Maybe a little over the top, but what the hell? What are you hearing about the First Lady, Brigitte? Because this story is crazy on the Googles and on the internets ever since Candace, my friend Candace Owens, did this this expose. Everybody's scratching their heads and wondering, do the French know about this, that everyone's talking about their First Lady being something other than a First Lady?
Rick, this is the number one topic in every bistro, in every cafe. And not now, for years.
I feel like I got to take a shower. I got to take a shower, but go on. I want to hear more.
And the thing, what Candace did is absolutely amazing, because this is now a mega topic all across the U.S., which was not until a few months ago. And when the average Frenchman and Frenchwoman, when they learn about that, they said, of course, because this is what we talk about every day here. So the Americans have to talk about it as well. Of course, once again, it's not your question. Has merit, because there are no smoking gun or guns so far proving the thesis about the First Lady or not lady. But there is enough evidence that could be dismissed with only one thing, Rick, a DNA test.
Yeah.
That's all it takes. With one DNA test, everything disappears. They have refused that DNA test over again. So there is something extremely fishy about it. And it became, for French people, it became of, look, they are destroying our republic, these people in the
area. Well, let me ask you this. And this is where the rubber meets the road for me. And I agree with Candace on this. And I'm not going one way or another. But if someone said, Pepe, I think when you were young, you were a woman, and eventually you turned into a man. How long would it take you to be able to refute that with pictures, with your mother, with your father, with your brother, with your sister, with your friends, with some? How long would it take you, Pepe?
For anybody, I would say the same day, Rick.
Yeah.
Literally. Or in the same few minutes. Yeah. If you have the goods, if you have your DNA test, if you have a
pictures.
Photo.
Yeah.
It's so easy.
Here's me. Yeah, here's me in a cheerleading outfit if I was a girl. Here's me playing football when I was a little boy. I mean, whatever.
Exactly. It's so simple.
Yeah.
So it already proves something that the overwhelming majority of French people already know, that there is something extremely fishy in the Élysée Palace environment and around it.
Let me talk about another one of your favorite people. Your friend John Bolton seems to be in a little bit of trouble. Sorry, I had to do that. Zing! It's an interesting dude, man. This guy's a real cat. This guy has, there's not, I said this earlier in my intro, there has never been a country that this guy does not want to attack, save, of course, the, you know, European friendlies. And he has a history of starting wars. He was a part of the people who started, as you know, the Iraq War, along with the rest of them. And then he hates Donald Trump. And suddenly his home is raided. What do you make of this whole situation?
Well, what a character. I interviewed him, Rick, in D.C. years ago at an APAC meeting. So you can imagine the scenery, yeah. Right? And, well, it was a 20-minute interview or so. I got all the answers that I wanted just by looking at him and the way he expresses himself and the tics and, you know, that hyena look when he talks especially about Palestine and Iran. Mm-hmm. It's frightening when you are face-to-face with somebody like that, you know. About the dodgy dealings, we still don't know.
Right, yeah.
None of us know. But for the FBI to do something like this, they must have some solid evidence backing that up, definitely. And it doesn't surprise me because the people who finance John Bolton, we have a pretty good idea about them, including the MEK, that anti-Tehran organization, which is basically paid by the Israelis and intel agencies from the West. And a guy like Bolton, who used to have a prominent position, is the perfect mouthpiece for their message, which is essentially the old John McCain message, bomb, 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 Iran, right? In 2005, 2006.
Yeah.
But it's a very character.
At least in defense of John McCain, and I'm no fan of John McCain because that's another guy who's just crazy war hawk, but at least with John McCain, you could say he was an actual warrior. This guy was a soldier. I mean, this guy went through hell in Vietnam. This other guy, I just found out, and I don't know if you heard me, I did a little Googling, and I found out that not only he was in the National Guard, big deal. That's where people of his generation went to not go to war. And then, as I'm sure you know, he was quoted as saying, I would never have gone to that war. Hell if I'm going to be buried in some rice paddy field.
In Southeast Asia.
Southeast Asia, right? Exactly. Just in case you didn't know what he was talking about.
I mean, this is as nasty as it gets, isn't it, Rick?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because everything is encapsulated into what he says. Everybody else is inferior. I'm not going to mingle with barbarians in a swamp in Southeast Asia. I'm very good. I'm too good for all that. Mm. I am above all that. So everything is encapsulated. I would say this is a shorthand for American exceptionalism in its worst aspects.
Agreed. Yeah, unfortunately, he does rise to that level. Where should we go next? I think let's go Israel. That attack I saw last night in Gaza, to me, I'm not a military expert, I'm not an expert on missiles, but that looked so predetermined, so planned, executed in such a heinous and cruel fashion that they would, A, shoot a missile into a hospital, and then B, back it up with a second missile when journalists and other rescue workers went there to try and assist those people who are being exterminated. I can't think of anything more mean, more cruel, Pepe. Can you?
No, we can't. As journalists, Rick, we can't. Very, very important for our audience. These are two war crimes in one.
Yeah.
You bomb a hospital, then you bomb health workers and journalists. Mm-hmm. And what happens afterwards? Absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. You have that infrahuman specimen. You showed the clip saying, we don't do this intentionally. So your unintentionally is always intentionally, obvious. And everybody knows that. And you have the numbers, like the numbers that you quote. And these are professional numbers. Yeah. Every day you have an attack against journalists, hospitals, ambulances, health workers, all of them together. Every day, day after day. Because it's, to encapsulate this in only one formulation is very hard. But they did it themselves. They consider everybody else Amalek.
Yeah.
According to their reading of the Torah. So they have to be exterminated, annihilated, harassed, sidelined, or killed. Mm-hmm. Exactly what they're doing in Gaza and soon in the West Bank. They want to purge the West Bank as well. So it's a death cult. And when you see a death cult posing as a nation state, as a sovereign nation state, attacking all their neighbors and even threatening to attack others, there is a veiled threat by Israel to attack Europe in determined circumstances. We all know about that. So we are all hostages of a death cult. And this is directly linked to the fact that another death cult, ISIS, is being admitted to the United Nations. You know what's going to happen next month. No? The leader of Al-Qaeda, ISIS in Syria, yeah, is going to win. So this is exactly the same thing. So this is the homogenization and normalization of death cults. Yeah. As long as they serve the same master. And we all know who the master is, right?
Wouldn't you think, though, I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's because I grew up Catholic or something, and my mother taught me to believe in God. But if there is a God in heaven, and he's looking down, and he's seeing these people do this kind of thing, don't you think that there has to be some kind of justice at some point? Sometimes I can't sleep at night thinking about the things that I see in the news. Wars, I understand. I hate them. I wish they would all end. But I understand sometimes when wars occur and there's friction between peoples or nations or communities, this that we're seeing in Gaza is not a war. It's an extermination. It's an annihilation of a mass or a race of people. At least that's how I see it. And I think that's as horrible as anything that can happen, as horrible, in fact, as what happened to the people who are now perpetrating this when the Nazis did it to them.
But history is not about good and evil, Rick. History has its own mechanisms. History is based on facts on the ground. For instance, if we go back to history and we analyze the Roman Empire as a whole, it was basically a killing machine. For all the great things that they gave us, of course, but it was essentially a killing machine. The great conquerors, Genghis Khan, Timur, Attila the Hun, you name it, they were also killing machines. Hmm. And with some, in the case of the Mongols, fascinating because they were also a very enlightened empire. But there were pyramids of skulls all over the place, you know. Hmm. So what Israel is doing in historical terms is not new. What is new is now that they can conduct a genocide in view of the whole planet, and there are no consequences because they know they can get away with it. I think this, from our point of view as journalists, this is the most frightening aspect. Whatever we do, whatever humanitarian workers do, nothing can. The only thing that would teach something to this death cult would be a military defeat. And we know this is not on the horizon, at least short term or mid term, you see?
Yeah.
But impunity is it's a horrible mark on all of us, all over the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a journalist. You're a journalist. I've spent my life in this profession, and I don't think I've ever felt as powerless.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and we are all powerless. And when I say we, it's the planet. Of course, I'm not talking about the institution. I'm not talking about the United Nations, which is now beyond a joke. I'm talking even about, now I'm going to be very, very blunt. Even the global South, the global majority, they are not being as blunt as they should to say, stop this now or there will be consequences. No, nobody's saying that. Even in the what we know, some leaks of, let's say, more or less secret conversations of the death cult in Tel Aviv with several other governments, there's never a leak that says, look, they got reprimanded really, really, really at the highest level. Mm. No, they didn't. So the sense of impunity is frightening, absolute, especially now where everything can be instantly checked, and your fake news reveal itself as fake news, just like you masked the Israeli fake news.
Yeah,
and still, it's nothing happens.
You know, it's the story of the guy or the gal who comes home and finds their spouse in bed with another lover and looks at them and said, how can you possibly do something like this to me? And the spouse in bed with another lover looks at them and says, Who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? You know, Israel is the spouse in bed with another lover, but they're doing something much, much more heinous, obviously. And they're literally looking at guys like you and me and saying, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes?
Exactly.
And it's troubling, man. Final point before we run out of time. I see you all over the place. You're one of the smartest guys out there, and I see you with McGregor and with Daniel Davis and with Napolitano. I love that guy.
The judge.
The judge. Here come the judge. And I think there's this consensus building amongst a lot of really smart geopolitical thinkers and military thinkers as well that if somebody doesn't stop what's happening in Ukraine, if Europe doesn't wake up and the United States doesn't wake up and Ukraine doesn't wake up and Zelensky doesn't wake up, the Russians are just going to have to continue to run roughshod all through the country because they keep saying, we want to stop. Give us a reason to stop. And nobody seems to want to give them a reason to stop. And short of that, I fear for Ukraine. I fear for that country. I was talking yesterday to a Ukrainian. He was sitting right here on the set, Pepe, with me. And I asked him, and he's a smart dude, man, Maxim. You know Maxim?
No, I never met him. No.
He's a brilliant guy. And when I asked him, I said, look, let's suppose everything finally gets fixed. Will you go back to Ukraine? You're a smart guy. You could be valuable. You could be a real leader in a country like that. And you're fair-minded. And he says to me, nope. I said, why? You love Ukraine. He goes, yep. Why wouldn't you go back? He goes, because that place is going to be a hellhole for a long time. That place is going to be ruined because it ain't going to be fixed overnight. You think he's right?
He's right, Rick, because he knows who runs the show in Kyiv, which is not the actor. It's the guys behind the actor. These are very dangerous. These are the guys, oligarchs, of course. Ukraine basically is a small basket of oligarchs, the same ones. And they control Pravi Sector, Azov Battalion, you know, the neo-Nazi, neo-fascist outfits who are behind the actor. The actor is just a messenger. He's a lowly actor and a lowly messenger who now thinks that because he's impersonating a president, he is a president. And that's basically what the Russians have been saying. Okay, we are ready to discuss anything, but it has to be with a legitimate leader. And this guy is completely illegitimate. And he is. According to the Constitution, he is an illegitimate president. And the Rada, the parliament, is also illegitimate. But I think the most, to come back to the US, after all, this war is an American war using NATO and Ukraine against Russia. It seems like Witkoff did not understand what Putin told him before Alaska. And it looks like Trump was also misled because Witkoff did not inform him correctly. Because Trump was under the notion that the Russians would agree to peacekeeping forces in Ukraine, which is the same thing as NATO forces in Ukraine.
You're right.
And it said, everybody, Rick, everybody knows that this is the mega red line for Russia. So we are back to square one again because we have the so-called Trump diplomat that didn't get it.
You know what I would say if I were Putin? I'd say, okay, you know what? I agree to the peacekeepers. For every one of your peacekeepers, we're going to have one of my peacekeepers. And by the way, your peacekeepers have to be made up of 75% Slovakians and Hungarians. Then I'll agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you see that Kyiv already vetoed the Chinese?
Yeah.
The number one superpower in the world economically.
Right. Yeah.
Already vetoed.
Exactly. No Frenchies, no Brits, no Germans. Okay. Now we can maybe talk about peacekeepers. Pepe, you're the best, man.
Thank you, Rick.
What a great conversation.
Pleasure talking to you.
No, the pleasure's really all mine. Thanks for the...
Are you going to be Vladivostok?
I am going to be in China this
You're
Thursday.
Going to the SCO in Beijing.
Yeah, I'm going to be going probably to both Shanghai and Beijing. I think that's going to be enormous with Modi.
Enormous.
Modi, you know, and Xi and Putin.
Everybody's going to be there, exactly.
Yeah, wow, yeah.
And Putin and Xi, exactly.
Yeah, I got my invitation. I'm excited about that. Then I'm going to go to Sochi for Voltai and... And then I'm doing I can't even remember. I'm doing a lot of things, Pepe. Ever since I got here.
You're doing an important tour of China, Russia. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, my friend, I'll tell you what a difference between being able to have access and actually talk to the newsmakers from the place in the world where most of the news is being generated, as opposed to sitting in one of our countries in the West, yeah, and depending exactly on the New York Times and CNN and the BBC to tell us truths that then we later find out are so far removed from the truth, I've never seen anything like it. So it's important to do the kind of things that you and I do when we travel and we find out the truths of this
world.
It is,
and there are not many like us, you know, reporting from Russia and China, for instance.
There should be. Yeah, they all go to London, they all go to Paris, they all go to Berlin. Why the hell, you know, the story can be in a different place.
And anyway, the big stories are in Russia and China.
They are. Yeah, they are. Thank you, Pip. I appreciate
it, my
friend.
Thank you so much.
Keep up.
My pleasure.
Be careful with those Frenchies over there. You know how they are.
No, I'm leaving to Russia this weekend.
Oh, so I'll see you here. Fantastic.
Okay, cheers.
I'll be in China. Bye.
Thank you so much.
That's it for us. Bye-bye. My God, what a wonderful conversation with Pepe. He's such a smart man. And it's always great to be able to bring you people like that who can share, you know, worldly perspectives on what's happening. Thanks so much. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'm so glad that you allowed me to come into your home and share these ideas with you. I have a podcast, by the way. It's called Journalistically Speaking. It's pretty cool. You're going to see some of Pepe's cuts on there, too. It's also on YouTube. And you can find me on X at Rick Sanchez TV. Love you guys. Take care. See you.